Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 18th of June, these are our main stories. A rebel attack on a school in western Uganda has left around 40 people dead, most of them teenagers. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has told Vladimir Putin that Russia's war in Ukraine is causing instability across the world and must be settled by diplomacy. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister has said that improving relations with Iran will help regional security and also ensure the safety of shipping in the Gulf. Also in this podcast, we hear from the former hostage Terry Waite on being awarded a knighthood.
I love this country and I value our traditions, and to be now incorporated in this particular way is very moving and means a great deal.
We begin in Uganda, and the country's military has said a rebel group set fire to a locked boys' dormitory and used machetes to kill female students during Friday night's attack on a school that left at least 40 people dead. Several students are also reported to have been abducted from the school in Umpondwe, close to the Congolese border. Officials are blaming the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, a radical Muslim group that launched a rebellion against President Yoweri Museveni's government in the 1990s. It has long been based in the neighbouring Democratic Republic of Congo. In recent years, some ADF attacks have been claimed by the Islamic State group. This woman was furious that the Ugandan authorities weren't there to protect the students.
If they are telling us the borders are secured, I want the security to tell us where they were when these killers came to kill our people. Why is it that we see them scattered here? Where were they at night? Because we are told people heard the gunshots as early as 10 p.m. and security could not come to combat the situation. Now this time they come in thousands. Where have they been?
I heard more about the attack from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
We understand from some people that there was an electricity outage at the time, so in complete darkness, a terrifying situation at the school as the gunman went into the dormitories. Some reports saying they shot open the rooms that were locked and then used machetes and other crude instruments to kill students in the room. And then there are reports that another dormitory had some kind of an explosive device thrown into it. So as the rebels were leaving, they threw something in through the window of another dormitory, killing a number of students in there. We think around 40 have been killed. It's unclear how many were abducted.
Could you just tell us more about this organisation, the ADF?
Yes, well, the ADF is very well known to Ugandans, the name, because back in the 1990s, it was very active in this same area of Western Uganda. At the time, it was a fairly extreme Muslim group opposed to the government of President Yoweri Museveni. And there were some very serious attacks with dozens of people killed. Again, a tertiary institution was targeted back then, and schools. But the Ugandan army responded and managed to push them across the border into Congo. And for many years now, they've been causing havoc along with the dozens of other armed groups in eastern Congo, surviving by kind of imposing taxes on people and probably getting their hands on some of the mineral wealth. But since then, very little really was heard of them for many years inside Uganda until the last 3 or 4 years, when there were some fairly small-scale bomb attacks, including in the capital Kampala, that the authorities blamed on the ADF. And then about 18 months ago, the Ugandan army went over the border into Congo and said they were going to rout the ADF in a military operation with the Congolese army, but it's quite clear it's still very active. And UN experts in a report a few months ago said there was no real evidence that it had been weakened at all. So it's clearly still a great threat. I ought to add perhaps that, you know, it's only the authorities who are saying this was the ADF. There's no sort of other evidence to back that up at the moment.
And there has been some anger locally from people around this school saying that because resources have been concentrated over the border in eastern Congo, that security was maybe more lax around this area.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I don't think this area of western Uganda was particularly on high alert. But one of the Ugandan military commanders actually said these rebels were in the area for at least 2 days prior to the attack. So that then opens up real questions of intelligence and why they hadn't found out more about the presence of these people. We also don't know how many of these people were involved in the attack, you know, whether it was just 3, 4 or 5 people or a much larger group. But yes, people are feeling very angry that there isn't and there hasn't been improved security. But I'm sure as the Ugandan military now goes after these rebels, we're likely to hear more from the authorities on what's going on. But serious questions about really what's gone on over the last 18 months during this military operation against the ADF.
Will Ross. African diplomacy has been attempting to mediate in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. A delegation of the continent's leaders, headed by the South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, has been talking to the two countries' leaders. First stop on Friday was Kyiv and President Zelensky. Then it was St. Petersburg on Saturday and President Putin. He praised what he called their balanced view on the war. Mr. Ramaphosa said the conflict was having a negative impact on many countries.
We do firmly believe that this war must be settled, and it must be settled through negotiations and through diplomatic means. We are here to communicate a very clear message that we would like this war to be ended.
But what realistic chance is there of translating this African initiative into a meaningful peace? And just why does Africa want to get involved? That's a question for our Harare correspondent, Shingai Unyoka.
We understand from President Cyril Ramaphosa, who addressed the press after his meeting with President Zelensky on Friday, that Africa has been disproportionately affected. About 1.2 billion people's livelihoods has been affected because of the increase in grain and fertilizer prices. A lot of African countries depend on both Ukraine and Russia for those particular products. And so they want to meet both these leaders to impress upon them the need to create a safe passage for the grain and the fertilizer. But they're also saying that they want to leverage on their perceived neutrality in this war. Many African countries have refused to take sides. They have abstained or voted not to condemn Russia. And so what they are saying is that they have the ear of President Putin. They would like to speak to him, to convince him to come to the dialogue table with President Zelensky.
What sort of response did they get from President Zelensky?
It wasn't a very favourable response. He outright rejected the proposal for dialogue. It's not the time for diplomatic overtures. And he said instead that they should impress upon Russia to withdraw from the occupied territory and also to release the children that have allegedly been abducted. However, President Cyril Ramaphosa has said that he really didn't expect a lot of movement. What they wanted is just to begin those talks.
And of course, there were attacks, missile attacks made on Kyiv during their meeting with President Zelensky. So at the moment, the environment for these sort of talks doesn't look promising at all.
It isn't promising at all. And that has been one of the criticisms about this peace initiative, about the timing of it. When Ukraine is launching its counteroffensive, and then we heard President Putin talking about nuclear weapons. But President Cyril Ramaphosa, as they arrived in Ukraine, they came under attack, says that there should be space for dialogue, even with this escalation of fighting.
Shingai Unyoka. The Russian Defence Minister has called for increased production of tanks for use in Ukraine. Sergei Shoigu spoke during an inspection of a Siberian military factory, which makes tanks and heavy flamethrowers. Russia is thought to have lost many hundreds of tanks since launching its full-scale invasion last year. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has intensified the Kremlin's efforts to promote its narratives at home. Almost all independent media has been banned, blocked, or subjected to military censorship, while the TV talk shows that emerged in the wake of the annexation of Crimea in 2014 multiplied to ensure that the state-sanctioned version of reality was constantly beamed into living rooms. Are there any corners of the Russian information space left untouched by what some Kremlin watchers have called the fire hose of falsehoods? Crassie Twigg from BBC Monitoring reports.
There's a programme called 60 Minutes. After the invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February last year, 60 Minutes became 2.5 hours long and has two episodes a day.
Francis Carr has lost count of the hours he spent watching Russian TV for BBC Monitoring. The talk shows he analyses have taken over the TV schedules. Two-thirds of the population get their news from what some Russians call the zombie box. Viewers would be familiar with language demonizing Ukraine, as well as regular threats directed at the West.
The one that really stood out was when Dmitry Kiselyov, this top anchor on Russia 1, the main channel in Russia, threatened to destroy what he described as the British Isles with either a Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile or a Poseidon underwater nuclear drone. Sarmat, the intercontinental ballistic missile, has actually become the subject of a song. And this song features lyrics about the missile disturbing NATO's dreams.
What happens when you look away from the TV screen? The internet is surely the place to find alternative points of view. Not quite, according to BBC Monitoring's disinformation team.
When you do searches about the war in Ukraine, the picture that you see is essentially that of parallel reality that you would normally see on Russian state TV.
Olga Robinson has done extensive research on Yandex, Russia's most popular search engine. She and the team did an experiment with search terms, one of which was Bucha, the place of a mass murder of Ukrainian civilians and prisoners of war. The team used a virtual private network, or VPN, to replicate the experience of a user based in Russia.
The top 10 results featured multiple really obscure blogs, three blogs that were all painting the picture that we either don't know what actually happened in Bucha, we don't know who killed the civilians, or they were not killed and Bucha was fake, or that it was the Ukrainians who did it, but definitely not the Russians.
It sounds like these search results would be markedly different from any other search engines. Olga was trying to find a credible explanation why that might be.
We spoke to both former engineers from Yandex and independent experts. They thought it was very unlikely that Yandex was manipulating results at such a huge scale.
Here's what Yandex told us.
Our algorithms work by ranking the relevance of any document for any particular query. It is not possible for any person to interfere with the search results.
Obviously, the crackdown in the independent media. We're talking about thousands of websites being blocked, so they disappear from Yandex's search results. Another possibility is that the Kremlin invests a lot into its media operations. Obviously, that includes knowing what kind of search terms to use and how to promote your content.
According to Olga, Telegram, the platform that hosts a lot of Kremlin narratives, also seems to be an accessible gateway for independent news, but only if you know where to look.
And you can hear more from the BBC Monitoring team on Russia's media landscape on this week's edition of the Global Jigsaw podcast. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due to visit China on Sunday, the first such trip by a top US diplomat in nearly 5 years. His visit was rescheduled in February when Washington said it detected and later shot down a Chinese spy balloon. President Biden has told reporters he also hopes to meet his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping over the coming months to talk about what he called their legitimate differences, but also to learn how to get along. To preview Blinken's trip, Paul Henley spoke to Zongguan Zoe Liu from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
I think this is a very significant visit, especially given the timing. Secretary Blinken is supposed to visit China in February, but because of America shooting down China's spy balloon and then a series of other cascading effects delayed the trip until being confirmed recently. The timing is also particularly important because after 3-year lockdown, there hasn't really been any significant high-level exchanges between China and the United States. So the timing is very important.
Of course, as far as China's concerned, it wasn't a spy balloon at all. And there is a chilliness in relations between the two countries remaining, isn't there?
Yes. And the chilliness in the bilateral relations, viewing from Beijing's perspective, actually dates back to the Trump era, from the trade war to a strengthened export control. And, you know, the COVID lockdown as well as the COVID origin dispute did not help either. So from Beijing's perspective, yes, you are right, Paul. There has been a series of chilliness.
So how is Antony Blinken going to demonstrate some kind of warmth towards China now?
The fact that Secretary Blinken is willing to visit China right now, even after Wall Street Journal recently had a story saying that China is building up another spy base in Cuba, even after the recent event and Secretary Blinken is willing to visit China, goes to show America is showing its willingness to move forward and move beyond. And the fact that the United States and China can confirm the trip instead of canceling it actually shows that, you know, both countries are willing to move forward.
Zongguan Zoe Liu from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Here in London, King Charles III has taken part in his first Trooping the Colour as sovereign. The ceremony has been a tradition of British infantry regiments since the 17th century and marks the official birthday of the British monarch. All the traditional pomp and pageantry were on display, as well as a spectacular flypast. Sarah Campbell reports.
King Charles has attended scores of Trooping the Colour parades during his lifetime, the first at the age of just 3. But this was the first time the birthday being celebrated was his. And there was a sight not seen for more than 30 years, departing Buckingham Palace, the monarch on horseback. The late Queen stopped riding her charger Burmese in 1986 and travelled by carriage from then on. The King's riding skills were tested, as his horse Noble seemed a little spooked by the sights and sounds of the thousands of people lining the Mall. Riding behind the King, his son Prince William, and siblings Prince Edward and Princess Anne. In an open carriage, the Queen, dressed in the bright red of the Grenadier Guards, and in green, the Colonel of the Irish Guards, the Princess of Wales. Sitting opposite and giving the occasional wave, Prince George, Charlotte, and sandwiched in between, Louis, to the delight of those who'd come to watch.
It's just all the colours and all the pageantry. It's just so British and so patriotic, and it just gives you a really good vibe to be here, really positive and uplifting.
Seeing all the horses going up and down with the cannons, that's exciting. Can't wait to see the flypast as well.
Yeah.
Love seeing the children as well and William on the horse. Yeah, brilliant.
On arrival at Horse Guards, the King took the salute.
Escort for the colour!
Trooping the Colour is the name for the military parade, which for more than 250 years has celebrated the monarch's official birthday. It's a reminder of the close bond between the sovereign and their armed forces. Given the honour of trooping their colour this year, the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards. The soldiers on parade will have rehearsed for months, ensuring whether it's a quick march or a slow walk, they are as one. The king remained on horseback throughout, almost 2 hours. After the parade, he and the royal family, along with a few hundred members of the household cavalry, processed back to the palace, uniforms glinting in the sunshine. As the 41-gun salute sounded from Green Park, the crowds were allowed to move forward along the Mall, cheering as the king and queen, along with family members, appeared on the palace balcony. In response, 5-year-old Prince Louis gave the crowd a salute. Overhead, the extended flypast, which had been planned for Coronation Day but was scaled back due to the weather. No such issues today for the aircraft taking part. This time a year ago, the Typhoon jets formed the number 70 in celebration of the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. 12 months later, the letters CR were formed, Charles Rex, a poignant reminder as to how much has changed over the past year.
Sarah Campbell reporting. Still to come?
Despite living in filthy swamps, the reptiles frequently get into fights with other saltwater crocs, yet rarely get infections because they have a formidable immune system.
So could the knowledge gained from crocodiles help humans develop treatments for resistant fungal infections? One of the world's longest surviving former hostages has been given a knighthood as part of King Charles's birthday honours. Sir Terry Waite was kidnapped in Lebanon in 1987 and spent nearly 5 years in captivity. After his release, he went on to found the charity Hostage International, helping others in the same situation. He also worked extensively for the homeless. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner, who has known him for some time, began by asking him for his reaction to his knighthood.
Well, it feels rather strange, really. There's a little story, actually, which I haven't told before. When I was a boy and I was playing with my sister, we played in a builder's yard, which was next door to the house, and there was some wet concrete, and she scrawled on it, "Sir Terry Waite." And she looked at me, and I must have been about 9 at the time. She said, "One day that will be you." And I thought, "My God, never, never in 1,000 years.
75 years of waiting, and now here you are. Your citation, which you kindly sent me, says specifically that this award is for the emotional and practical support you have provided to those in need within the UK and internationally, including hostages and their families, children, young people and the homeless, delivered in person and through the numerous charities that you founded or worked with. For the benefit of those who were born long after you were released from captivity, can you just remind everybody, because you were and are perhaps the world's most famous living ex-hostage?
Well, I'd been promised to see a hostage who was ill and about to die. And instead of allowing me to see the individual, I found myself in captivity in an underground cell, which was tiled. I was chained to the wall for 23 hours and 50 minutes a day. I slept on the floor. I had no natural light, no companionship. I was in solitary confinement for almost 5 years, except towards the last few weeks when I spent time with fellow hostages John McCarthy and Terry Anderson.
What kept you going at the time? I mean, I know there was a piece of music, wasn't there? The Dream of Gerontius at one point, which was fairly late on in your captivity, that must have been a huge morale boost.
For many years, I was completely isolated from any news of the outside world, except I used to tap on the wall to hostages in the next cell, and they conveyed to me messages by tapping on the wall, but that was it. And then towards the end of captivity, I was given a small radio, and I remember balancing it on the iron bar that held my shackles to the wall, and I was able to tune in to the World Service. And I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the World Service. They brought me a great deal of consolation and support in those years. But then it was the first night of the proms, and it was the Dream of Gerontius, and this was the first music I'd heard for years.
Now, when you got released in the early 90s, after all these years in captivity, you were, I think, extended some surprise hospitality by somebody rather important.
We got a message to say that the late Queen would be very happy for us to go up to Balmoral and spend as much time as we wish there. So my wife, myself, my children, we flew up in a Hercules, believe it or not, to RAF base up in Scotland, where we changed into a helicopter. I mean, what a contrast from riding in the boot of a car in Beirut to dropping in a helicopter onto the front lawn of Balmoral. It just gave us the opportunity to have that time together and to have that privacy, which, you know, you so need, because it does take time to get back into life and get back into the normal swing of things. I think it was a wonderful gesture by the Queen.
I suppose my final question is, what advice would you give to somebody who is in captivity and is struggling to see light at the end of the tunnel?
Interesting you ask that, because these days I'm in contact with somebody who is in captivity, who's in arbitrary detention. I won't say where he is or who it is. I can advise him to say, look, you can still have a reasonably full life if you use your mind and you do not allow yourself to fall into deep despair. In my cell, I was in the dark much of the time, and the shutters, metal shutters, were in front of the window, so no natural light came in. But there was a small chink of light that came in when the sun rose. And I used to say to myself, remember, light is stronger than darkness. Keep hope alive.
Sir Terry Waite talking to our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. In recent months, the former arch rivals of Saudi Arabia and Iran have grown closer following mediation from China. On Saturday, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud, arrived in the Iranian capital Tehran to continue efforts to normalise relations. Our Middle East regional editor Yusuf Taha reports.
The Sunni kingdom broke off diplomatic relations with Shia Iran 7 years ago after Iranian protesters attacked its embassy in Tehran and consulate in Mashhad in reaction to the execution of a prominent Saudi Shia cleric, Ayatollah Nimr al-Nimr. The visit by Prince Faisal bin Farhan is another major step on the road to normalizing ties. President Ibrahim Raisi told the foreign minister that the enemies of Islam, spearheaded by Israel, are upset at improving ties between their two countries. The prince told his host that a golden opportunity has presented itself to strengthen relations to a strategic level. Mr. bin Farhan also handed the Iranian leader a formal invitation from King Salman to visit the kingdom. Following his talks earlier with his Iranian counterpart, Mr. bin Farhan said improving relations with Iran would help regional security and ensure maritime safety in the Gulf. Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his Saudi counterpart told the news conference that they had agreed that resolving the Palestinian cause was crucial. The Saudi foreign minister is also reopening his country's embassy in Tehran after Iran officially reopened its own in Riyadh 10 days ago. The thaw in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran is being felt beyond their borders, with the departure of the first commercial flight since 2016 from the Yemeni capital, which is controlled by the Houthi rebels, for the Saudi city of Jeddah. A Saudi-led coalition has been fighting the Iran-backed Shia Houthis to reinstate Yemen's internationally recognized government. The Yemeni Airways aircraft is carrying more than 250 pilgrims who will perform Hajj in Mecca.
Yusuf Taha. Let's return now to the conflict in Ukraine. In recent days, New Yorkers have had the opportunity to laugh about wartime life in the European country. That sounds strange, doesn't it? A stand-up comic from Kyiv has been performing at two New York City comedy clubs and believes humour is a good way to get people talking about the conflict. Tom Brook sent this report.
The Greenwich Village Comedy Club gave a warm welcome to stand-up comedian Hannah Kochahora, who'd come all the way to New York from Kyiv. New Yorkers liked her humour.
I'm afraid that the rocket will hit my building, the wall will come down, and everyone will see how I live. And, yeah, and my mom will be, I told you to clean up.
Hannah told me she believes that laughter by way of stand-up comedy is vital in times of war.
I think it's most appropriate. First of all, it's rebellious. It's against everything that Russia wants us to be, like depressed, hopeless, and tired. And secondly, I think it's normal in the times of darkness to find something light and joke about it. And even if it's a dark joke, if you can laugh about it, it's not so scary and it's just kind of better. Because a lot of Ukrainian humor now is very dark. Oh, hello. Are there any Russians here?
Yeah. Hannah has been doing her stand-up comedy at two different venues in New York City. Her humor is connecting with American audiences. It's getting them to relate to the war in Ukraine in a way that's quite different from daily news journalism.
It was definitely cool to see like a first-person experience and someone bring some lightheartedness to it.
At first, it was a little like, I don't know if I should be laughing, but I think she very opened up about her experience and made you feel comfortable to kind of get in on the joke.
I think it humanized it a little bit. I think it made it a little more real, but in a lighthearted way, which was good for the audience to engage with but not get overwhelmed by.
Hannah can also be seen in a documentary being shown at the Tribeca Festival in New York. It follows her and three other stand-up comics in wartime Ukraine. The documentary's producer, Krista Liney, says all the stand-up comics have, to varying degrees, been inspired by Ukraine's President Zelensky, who has a background as an actor and a comedian.
Absolutely. They all have reverence for Zelensky. I think that they all were inspired in some way by him. Not maybe perhaps necessarily to do stand-up, but they appreciate, I feel like they have a certain connection with him because of that.
I love New York. There's zero chances to die of Russian rockets, you know?
Hannah may be making Americans laugh, but to her, this is no funny business. With her humor, she is trying to show New Yorkers that Ukrainians are resilient. And she hopes that by seeing that, maybe Americans will support Ukrainians more.
Tom Brook reporting. Researchers in Australia say a discovery about crocodiles could be used to help humans suffering from fungal infections, which are resistant to treatment. Francis Reed reports.
The scientists at La Trobe University in Melbourne looked at how crocodiles avoid infection despite living in filthy swamps. The reptiles frequently get into fights with other saltwater crocs, suffering deep wounds or even losing limbs, yet rarely get infections because they have a formidable immune system. The researchers looked at defensins in the animals, small proteins that can detect germs, which can turn themselves on and off dependent on the pH of the crocodile's watery habitat. Scott Williams is from the university's Institute for Molecular Science.
When it was in a sort of neutral environment, like you'd find in the blood, where it's about pH 7, the defensin didn't work well. But when the pH dropped to an acidic pH, which you typically find in a fungal infection, all of a sudden it turned on and it could clear the infection. And this pH regulation mechanism is quite interesting because we haven't seen it before for any other defensin in other animals.
They say their findings could be used as a template to help treat infections in humans because we have proteins that are similar to crocodile defensins. While many people are aware of bacterial infections which are resistant to antibiotics, drug-resistant fungal infections have started to become more of a problem, with warnings in places like the US about the potential spread in healthcare facilities.
Francis Reed. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer. The producer was Liam McSheffrey, and the editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time. Goodbye.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
People go to jail here for insulting the president. People are afraid to express their views on social media. They're certainly terrified to go to a demonstration.
We look beyond the headlines, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news.
Why is the volatile Wagner Group boss screaming insults at the leaders of Russia's armed forces?
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.